It's very interesting to be in a church. It got me thinking. Some parallels here between the church, the Bible, with its Bible, with its priests, and its congregations, and the body politic, us, with our Bible, the Constitution, the government with its own priests, and how all that works. I mean, the Bible is kind of a creation story. Well, I guess it's not kind of a creation story. But, you know, the Constitution is the product, and around our Constitution, this country has built up a creation story with all kinds of myths and tales about, you know, what came first and what sort of natural law and what then humans did to add to it. It's provided endless, both the Bible and the Constitution have provided endless opportunity for squabbling and arguing over the true meaning of words, of phrases. I mean, there are books and books and books going, you know, analyzing each phrase of both. It has opened the door to what is heresy and blasphemy, not just in terms of religion, but in terms of the Constitution. They both created a kind of shorthand. I mean, the myths have been going on for so long, and the stories and tales, that there's a shorthand of both, that if you're living in the culture where that shorthand is prominent, you don't have to tell the whole story in order to convey your message. You only have to give a little piece of it because everybody knows what happened in the Garden of Eden, or everybody knows what happened with Joseph and his brothers, whatever. Everybody knows what happened at the Constitutional Convention, the Founding Fathers, you know, all the aspects of the myth. So if you're not the heretic, if you're not the blasphemer, you don't have to tell the whole story, you just have to give a little bumper sticker of it. And that reveals everything else. And you see that especially when, in some of the stories Tom was telling, in some of the briefs, in the court cases, when the lawyers for the corporations, they only have to tell the bumper sticker in order to sort of access everybody to the whole myth, to the creation story, to the founding fathers. Whereas the communities and the municipalities that are defending their laws, they have to say, well, wait a minute, it's another story here. That's not the story. And they can't use a bumper sticker because it's not in the common parlance. So they sort of have to tell the whole story. And we're going to do a little bit of that tonight. Now, what Tom Lindsay describes has required and continues to require a huge amount of work. You know, they're taking a problem that comes up in these communities that are not, you know, despite what Tom is putting forward, they're not monolithic. Even a community of 5,000 people has different views, different perspectives, people with different experiences. And there they are, people spending time, people who have families and people who have jobs, people who have lives, and they're spending time coming together to rethink the problem. You know, corporations want to come in and bring a hog farm to their community. Oh, it's obvious, the problem is the hog farm. The problem is the corporation. What is the problem? What is it we're going to do? How do we, before we jump into action, before we commit ourselves to a couple of years of work to have our cake and cookie sales and do all the things that we do and telephone trees and our meetings and talking and talking and talking and standing and tarring, feathering and doing all the things that we know how to do? Are we really sure that we know what the problem is? So we're going to spend time in rethinking and reframing in order to figure out what to do. And in doing this, we're going, sometimes some of these communities, they did not take the advice of the municipal solicitors. Because often their reaction is, well, you can't do what you're thinking. You have no rights here. I mean, they essentially, they're in the same story as the corporate lawyers are saying. They're saying, you have no right to do this. So the question I'm asking is, why are they spending all this time trying to do something different from what they've been doing? Why are they reconfiguring their civic action groups from what they had been designed to do, which was to fight the permits, which was to deal with one single issue at a time? Why are they doing that? Well, there's a number of reasons, and they really go to the core of this work. And they center around what I think the reality is, and that is our civic groups, I would say for most of the 20th century and into the 21st now, most of the civic activism in this country has been focused on, in a defensive mode, stopping what some other people are trying to impose upon us, stopping some effort by other people to harm our communities, harm us, or deny us rights. One issue at a time, and over and over and over again. Right? And cumulatively, they have not added up in terms of shifting real governing power from the few people who started off running this country in the beginning to the many people who actually live here. It hasn't worked. And so what they're doing in Pennsylvania, people are beginning to struggle and say, well, what is it we don't know? What is it we haven't known, we haven't understood about this country? What is it we need to know in order to be more effective, in order to rethink the work, in order to reconfigure our organizations? We also don't have the tools, or the tools that we've been using haven't been working. Because the tools that we mostly have been using have been the compromised results of defeats of people who, I'm talking about most of the 20th century, who were not going for the underpinning. And we're using basically the tools of reformers and efficiency experts that came out of the progressive movement, the progressive era, and out of the New Deal. Nobody should be offended by that. I think it's amazing how long people have gone in this country without provoking some really fundamental ferment of questioning, you know, how we resist, how we are being channeled. And I'll elaborate a little bit on some of the stuff that Tom talked about in terms of the regulatory world. I mean, the first regulatory laws, starting with the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, and then at the beginning of the 20th century, food and drug laws and some health laws, and then starting with the New Deal, a whole slew of regulatory laws, and then with the labor environmental movements. Basically, with the regulatory laws, which people fought very hard for, and I must say, probably have clearly prevented some worse things from happening. But the problem with the regulatory laws is they set up a structure where we basically concede to a class of people clothed in the corporation, and as Tom described, then therefore clothed in the Constitution. We concede that they basically have the authority to determine the kind of communities that we have, the kind of societies we have, to make the rules. And not only to make the rules, but to make the rules for making the rules. We concede to them. There is no, for the past 100 years, there has been no counterforce to the corporate class to challenge the corporate class authority to govern in this country. And if we look at the difference between the populist movement and the progressive era, we can see that distinction very clearly. Whereas the populists, the farmers, and the workers, the intellectuals who rose up at the last 20 years of the 19th century, what they saw was the beginning of a corporate state emerging out of what had been the slave state, the slave constitution, the slave nation from its beginning until the Civil War. They saw the corporate state coming out of the rise of the robber barons, the mixing of the northern capitalists and the southern ex-slave masters. And they said, we cannot have a republic, we cannot have a democracy, we cannot govern ourselves, we cannot have rights if one class of people rises up and seizes special privilege backed by the law of the land, backed by the Constitution. One of their platforms in the People's Party in 1892 said, let us first determine that we have a republic to administer before we begin fighting with each other about how we're going to administer it. Right? Let us first determine that we, the people, are in charge, as the great language of some of the great founding documents said, before we get into the details of how many parts per million, how much poison, who can poison whom. Right? They watched, because it was happening in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, they watched as the legal system declared investment and production and work off the public agenda, to make it private law instead of public law. And they fought it and they resisted. But in fact, they lost. So by the end of the 19th century, you had a whole reconfiguring of the law, and you had the most fundamental decision-making that would determine our lives, our communities in the future, determine the work that we do, concentrated in the hands of the few by law. And so when, in fact, they began to, the corporate lawyers, with the help of progressive leaders, began to set up the regulatory structure, they began to do that to channel us you know, the source of all political power in this country, the sovereign people, to channel us away from constitutional questions, away from fundamental questions of rights, who get rights, who defines what, who's in charge, who gets to wield the law against whom, who gets to wield the might of the nation against whom, who gets to wield the Constitution against whom. It's very much biblical. Who gets to wield, you know, for millennia, haven't we, people been struggling? Who wields the clout of the Bible against whom? Who can hold up the Bible and say, this is the word of God, this is the truth, you're the blasphemer, this is the way? It's very similar with the Constitution. You know, we get to say, you know, who gets to say, this is the sacred text, and therefore, in this case, the armed might of the nation is on that side. So when you get to a regulatory arena, you know, enforcing the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or a local zoning board hearing or a local planning board meeting or a National Labor Relations Act board, the realm of stuff that can be raised, the issues that can be raised, has already been limited decades before. And in addition to which, the corporation's lawyer is sitting there representing the corporation as a person at that proceeding, just like a human flesh and blood person. So in your little community, you got a problem at the zoning board. There's some issue going on. The corporation is sitting in your zoning board. It's sitting at your planning board. It's sitting at the EPA hearing. It's sitting at the appeals court hearing. And it's not just sitting there, just the lawyer by himself, sitting there with the accumulation of the law that had taken place across the previous generations. And with the accumulation of the lore, L-O-R-E, of the culture, with the accumulation of how the language has been seized and bastardized, with the accumulation of how the corporate class has seized the rights of people, and in fact, with its agglomerating, concentrating its wealth, is denying the rights of people. Because when the General Motors Corporation speaks, and when the Microsoft Corporation speaks, they drown us out. Right? When the General Motors Corporation takes out ads and spends hundreds, you know, tens of billions of dollars talking about the way of life and all that, we are drowned out. When they support certain issues through their advertising, we are drowned out. So we go to the, you know, we struggle to pass these regulatory laws and have for 100 years. And then we struggle to enforce them. And even if we win, what are we winning? What we're enforcing is a request or a plea that they cause a little less harm, you know, invade a few less of our rights. And we cannot raise the broader question of consent of the governed and what was the revolution about and what happened at the Constitutional Convention and what was Reconstruction about and what was the abolitionist struggle and what was the populist struggle and what was the struggle, the great struggles for rights that have continued on through every generation. We tie our hands behind our backs. And yet, it's really quite extraordinary to watch on certain kinds of regulatory laws how they sort of cycle back and forth. One of my favorites is the Surface Mine Control and Regulation Act that was passed in 1978. You know, every 10 years or so, some young environmental lawyers come up and said, hey, you know, they're cutting off whole mountaintops in Appalachia now. We've got to sue to enforce the Surface Mine Control Act. And they, you know, they sue the EPA, they sue the Corps of Engineers that gives out the permits in order to dump all the crap in the streams. You know, and they hold press conferences and say, we're going to sue to enforce the Surface Mine Act. They don't stop and look at the history of the Surface Mine Act. And the history is this, that in the early 70s, a group of people in Appalachia who had lived through 100 years of seam coal, underground coal mining, and they saw that there was a move to surface mining, to strip mining, said, we want to ban strip mining in Appalachia, in our communities, because we know it's going to happen. And they began to to organize and mobilize and educate and do the things they needed to do in order to pass a federal law banning strip mining. And they were pretty successful. They got to Washington. They got some support. They got to Washington, and some of the large environmental groups said, we'll help you. It's a great cause that you're going after. We're going to help you do that. And they helped them, all right. They helped them write a law that regulated strip mining. And these people, the people from Sachem, the name of the group, Save Our Cumberland Mountain, Sachem, they saw what was happening, and they tried to resist, and the coal industry and the Carter administration and the environmental leaders came together, and they passed that bill. And the Sachem people boycotted the signing at the White House, and they stood out front and said, we know what's going to happen here. Because what this does is legalize the strip mining of communities, and it prevents our local communities and our state from passing any laws. It cuts the whole rug out from under us. The Corps of Engineers, 99% of the permit applications of the mining companies, they go through. Go look at pictures of this dynamite at the top of the mountains. That's what the mountaintop removal is. So if they had looked, these young, valiant, zealous environmental lawyers, they would have seen the law is doing what it was designed to do. It's working. There's no point to suing for enforcing the law. The law is being enforced. And if you actually go and read the language of the Toxic Substance Control Act and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Labor Relations Act, as I read them anyway, I think that what they really do, these laws, the only things these laws regulate are workers and environmentalists. And they enable and empower the corporations. And so, one of the things that my colleagues and I in POCLAD for the last decade have been urging people who want to get active into the political process, who want to change things, is that we need to spend some time rethinking the nature of the problem. If we're going to invest our time and energy over years and years to do things, it does make some sense to invest our time and energy to define the problem before we jump at the solution. I think there's a lot of data out there. We have a lot of experience when we look back over our history, starting with some recent history. Now, why is it that it's been so easy for a relatively few number of people to think up some really stupid ideas and then turn them into policy and law and reality? You know, think back to the couple of months leading up to the invasion of Iraq. There was enormous resistance in this country. It was organized. It was clear. It was on the streets. It was everywhere. It was vocal. People were very experienced. It made hardly a dent. Right? Why is it so hard? Was it so hard to stop that? And why was it so easy for a relatively few number of people to impose that policy? Think back over the years. Why did it take so long for almost every success in terms of right struggles in this country? You know, we think back to the creation story about the Constitution that's most prevalent. You know, one of the aspects of the creation story is, well, we had these wonderful people, the smartest set of people and the most committed set of folks in the history of the cosmos came together to write the nation's founding document. And they made a plan of governance which enabled for problems and disputes to be settled through politics, through elections, you know, through the mechanisms of democracy, through the courts, you know, so that there was no need to be like the Europeans to have fights over everything. We could go through this. It was a rational way to do things. Well, you know, why did it take so 80 years to end slavery? Why did it take another 100 years to end Jim Crow? Why did it take how many generations for women to get the right to vote? Why did it take so long for labor unions to be undeclared criminal conspiracies? And why do working people still have so few rights? You know, you work for a corporation. As soon as you cross the property line, you have no constitutional rights. So where does that come from? Why is it? I mean, I see a lot of gray hair in this room. I suspect a lot of you have been involved in all kinds of struggles over the last 30, 40 years. You know, in energy, in food, in transportation, in housing, in human rights. Why is it that we're so far from the sane and logical transitions in each of those realms that many of us almost could taste 30 years ago? What a lot of people envisioned was possible 30 years ago, we are so far from. Is that because, you know, most of the people in this country wanted the policies that we ended up having? You know, how many people are clamoring for NAFTA and the WTO to nullify all kinds of things? How many people are clamoring for the Supreme Court to be nullifying laws? How many people demanded that we go from returnable glass bottles to throwaway plastics? How many people demanded that? You know, How many people are demanding more poisons in the air, more poisons in the food, you know, genetic engineering of food? You know, the masses of people are constantly rising up and saying, please give us all this stuff, right? So why is it that a relative handful of people have been able to determine and set the policies and keep us on the defensive and channel us into work organizing year after year so that even when we don't win much? I think we have to think a lot about what's happened to our heads, you know, the psychology of all this. There's a lot of talk about corporate power and corporations and democracy. So I thought I would also spend a couple minutes trying to define down a little bit more clearly how I understand what the problem is. What is the problem with corporations? One of the first things I've done is I throw out a bunch of phrases to say what it's not. So that the problem has nothing to do with corporate responsibility or corporate accountability or good or bad corporate citizenship and language of that kind. So I just put that aside. That's not relevant. And then I look at, well, legal and illegal. You know, we have a lot of since some of the sort of most prominent catastrophes of the last 5 or 6 years, we have some of the big corporations like Enron and WorldCom being indicted for stuff for breaking the law. And then we get the Sarbanes-Oxley bill passed that's going to take care of those abuses. But the problem is not when corporations break the law, because there are laws to deal with that. I'm much more concerned with what corporations do, what the people running corporations do, that's considered legal by the law and considered legal by the lore, L-O-R-E, by the culture. When corporations deny constitutional rights for their employees, that is legal by the law and the lore. When corporations pour their billions of dollars to bastardize the electoral process and the legislative making process, when corporations lobby, that's legal. When corporations write the Telecommunications Act of 1996, that's legal. Right? Most of the harms, the rights denials, and the assaults are legal. When the DuPont Corporation spews X thousands of pounds or thousands of tons of known deadly chemicals into the air in the ward every day, and their vice president says, we have a permit for this from the state of Delaware or the state of Michigan or the state of Washington, it's legal. You go and look in your state corporate code. Corporations should have the rights of persons. So when they, in fact, sit in on your zoning boards and sit in on your planning boards, and when they sue to nullify laws because they allegedly deny this corporation's equal protection of laws, a due process of laws, a First Amendment free speech rights, it's legal. You know, when the Commonwealth of Massachusetts passes a law a few years ago like it did, banning advertising of tobacco products within 100 feet of a school, not the most communist law ever passed in the history of the world, right? And the American Tobacco Company and the Lorelei Company go to federal court and sue and say, this violates our corporation's First Amendment rights under the United States Constitution. And the Supreme Court rules 9-0 in their favor. And that law is struck down. And those billboards go up next to the school. It's legal. It's a very long list. If we made a list here of the laws that the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional because a suit was brought by a human person claiming that that law violated some human right found in the Constitution. And we compare that list to the laws, local, state, and federal laws passed from the beginning of this country that were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court out of suits brought by corporations saying that those laws denied them their constitutional rights. That list will be 1,000 to 1. So not only have the efforts of people, you all know what it takes to pass a law, whether at a municipal level or state or federal. I mean, we're talking about work. I mean, it took 25 years to ban child labor, 30 years, in some of those big struggles. So if we're talking about 1,000 laws that have been declared unconstitutional, laws passed by majorities of people in their communities, we're not only losing those laws, but talk about the chilling effect. I mean, which legislators are going to want to continue passing laws knowing that, in fact, they're going to be, I mean, they're not even under consideration. So the problem is what it is that these corporations, the men and women running these corporations, the corporate managers and agents, what is it they do that's legal and constitutional? They are fundamentally using the law and the Constitution and the culture that they have created to define our lives, to define what is it that's produced, how it's produced, what work is to be done, what's happening to the earth. And with their ability to, in fact, be the government. I mean, I think what we have is a corporate state. And what we have is a corporate constitution that is the basis for that state. And I think to help to see it, it's often said fish discover water last. We're living in that corporate state. And sometimes it's difficult to actually see what's going on. So I wanted to talk a few minutes about the slave state, because it's far enough away, and slavery is kind of a discredited notion, at least at this point, thankfully so. And maybe we can see a little better if we look at another kind of issue that's similar in another time. So despite all the denial, you know, we have, you know, in terms of the creation story again, we have, you know, the Constitution, when the Constitution was ratified, this set up a democracy or a republic, depending how people look at it, where, you know, as George Bush said when he was in Senegal for an hour last year, speaking at one of the slave stations, disembarkation points, he said, the United States of America was set up where all men were created equal, but somehow, for a while, America became a prison for African Americans. Well, you go back and read the Constitution and look at the laws of the states, and in fact, 80% of the people at the time in North America were denied rights by 20%. Not only African American slaves, but African Americans who weren't slaves, women, indentured servants, white men without property, native peoples, not to mention the fauna and the flora of the mountains and rivers. So you had 20% of the people using the law of the land, to deny the rights of 80%. And they set up a slave system, or they continued the slave system that it existed. But they set it up, it was, you know, what is a system? It's not just an isolated relationship between a master and a slave. It, in fact, covered the entire country, the slave system. And it was a mechanism of ordering society and enabling the slave masters to control the government. Now, I'll talk to the second thing first. There were two parts in the Constitution that were very relevant. One, there's a return bonded labor clause in the Constitution, the only time labor is mentioned in the Constitution. You might know the law that reflected that better as the fugitive slave law. That if a bonded laborer, a slave or an indentured servant, ran away and ran to a non-slave state, ran to the North, the government, local, state, or federal, was required to return that slave to his or her master, so that the full force and might, the armed might of the nation, was to support the institution of slavery. Secondly, there's a three-fifths clause in the Constitution that slaves were to be counted as three-fifths of a person. What that meant was for the assignment of members of that Congress and members of the Electoral College. And that meant that the slave states took three-fifths of a person for each slave and were appropriated more congressional representatives and more electoral college representatives, which means that up until the Civil War, the slave states controlled the federal government. To the extent that even in the House of Representatives in 1820 at one point passed a resolution banning any debate on slavery in the House of Representatives. The northern merchants, the northern investment people, were invested in the slave plantations. They held the mortgages in the plantations. They were part of the slave trade. They owned the ships. Go to Rhode Island. Can't think of the town. Newport, Rhode Island, you'll see the huge mansions built out of slave money from the north. It was a system around which the whole country was organized. And in fact, in the 1820s, 1830s, if you were a northern person, talking about abolition, you know, raising questions about slavery, in the North, your own neighbors and friends would accuse you of treason, because it was slavery that had brought freedom, liberty, progress, and wealth. It was the status quo. It was what was working. And anybody that spoke against that and started to raise the idea that we should have something else, in fact, was considered a traitor to the United States. So that's sort of the background, that you have a slave system. Yet, you know, the law was, there was a default set up, you know, that accepted the notion that human beings were not persons. Human beings had no rights. There was no First Amendment in the South. You could not, in South Carolina or North Carolina, Virginia, if you were anti-slavery, you could not have a meeting and talk about abolition. You could not teach slaves to read. You know, and it was the law that came in to deal with you. It wasn't this, I mean, there was a lot of violence, private violence. But in fact, when you have a system, what that means is, you know, when it's driven into the Constitution, what that means is that it is the law that is enforced against you. It is the sheriff that comes after you. Right? If in fact some of the northern abolitionists had been captured in the North and brought south to trial, as which many states tried to do, it was the state that it would have tried. It was the state that would have put them in jail or executed them for violating the law, for being treasonous. So, just as with the Jim Crow laws, the legal segregation laws, it was the law of the land. It was it was the legislature and the courts that in fact enabled that to happen. And that the historian C. Van Woodward has a very clear line that he uses, that during the years of segregation, the conductor on a train, you know, carried with him the majesty of the law. Because he's the one, when he said to an African American, you must sit in a different railroad car, if the African American did not obey, then he would call the sheriff. And then the person would be then subject to the criminal law system. It's very much like if you have some earth firsters sitting out inside a warehouser, enter into warehouser corporation land to save some trees, right? And some of the corporation private guards come and they start threatening the occupiers. And both the occupiers and the warehouser corporation calls the sheriff seeking a remedy. Who is the sheriff going to help? The sheriff is going to arrest the people for violating, for trespass on the private property. You know, he's not going to arrest the warehouse corporation for destroying an ecosystem. So you got, once the law is involved that way, you know, who gets to wield the law against whom? Who gets to call the sheriff? Is one of the principal hallmarks of when you have a system like that. And if we look at our system today, our corporate state today, and our corporate constitution today, that's where it comes out. Because most of the harms, most of the violations of rights, of people's rights, and the harms to life and community, which corporations are causing today in this country, are considered by the law as legal and considered by the law, by the culture, as essential for the American way of life, as essential for jobs, as essential for liberty, as essential for security, as essential for progress. How many times have you heard, oh, if you pass this health law or this environmental law, it'll throw people out of work, it'll destroy the economy, right? And how many elected officials do we have around the country who don't believe that, right? We're trying all the time to persuade and convince elected officials who believe that is the essence and the source of the progress and jobs and wealth and goodness and liberty and security in this country, and that the essence of that is the production of endless more forever and ever and ever and ever. That anything that interferes with the production of endless more, with fewer and fewer people making the endless more, of course, is a menace, is a traitor to the American way of life. So going back again to we, the people, trying to organize and persuade, you know, we keep electing these people who believe, who've been convinced by the corporate culture over the last 100 years, you know, who maybe went to Harvard or maybe went to MIT or maybe went to Stanford or the University of Washington, and they, you know, and they keep coming out. They're being taught that the essence of the goodness and the progress and jobs and liberty and freedom of this country is the ability to produce more and more and more of anything possible. And what makes that happen is the efficiency of the corporate system, the efficiency of the corporation, and it's private. And if we start interfering with that, if we let the people, the rabble, interfere with that, we'll destroy the whole thing. There is no alternative. You know, and so the AFL-CIO pours in tens and tens of millions of dollars, giving it to Democrats and Republicans who believe this, and then go to them after election and say, please, in this instance, vote a little differently. And so do most of the environmental groups and human rights groups and all of that. We're helping them, giving all this money to elect these people. So we're not electing ourselves. We're not electing people who believe as we believe. Our aspirations, our work don't match our aspirations. And then we're surprised when people who believe what they believe and who are elected for what they believe and who are helped by the corporate state, we're surprised when they don't respond to what it is that we want. Some of the great social political movements in this country, like the abolitionist movement and the populists, one of the things that makes them different from the work today, the single issue, endless defensive work, is that they really were focused on rights and self-governance. And that's the direction that the work in Pennsylvania is going, that we have to go. They really were about rethinking all of the stuff that we've been taught about what's good and what's evil and where jobs come from and what progress is and what we've been told. They're thinking back. They're looking back to past movements. They're trying to learn from what people had done. And I think, you know, going back to the sort of the Bible and the Constitution, they're reading these documents for themselves and say, well, let's you know, and getting together in groups and say, what does this mean? And, you know, they're actually studying. Thomas mentioned one thing. He said the abolitionists, you know, when they got together and focused on their program, they did not demand a slave protection agency. Right? That would have been very logical, right? Slave conditions were awful. If there had only been some government entity that would have, you know, limited the punishments and set some rules and all that, it would have probably helped a lot of people's lives. But no, they defined it in a different way. And you know what? It took a couple of generations of work, of thinking, of talking, debating, of study to define it as they defined it. And how they defined it was what slavery is in the United States was government fundamentally denying the rights of a whole class of people. So that the target of their work, and that was totally contrary to the notion of republican form of government and inalienable rights and all the good stuff that we all learned in third grade. And so that the target of their work was not going to be the slave masters. They didn't go around negotiating with slave masters to be socially responsible. Right? They didn't go around with slave masters so they would sign voluntary codes of conduct. Right? They said, our fight is not with the slave masters because we're going to put you off the earth. But our focus is, in fact, our public officials, our public servants, it's government. And therefore, the arena is the village square, and the arena is our legislatures. And they trained enough people out of this debate and drove them into the Congress and the House and the Senate so that when, in fact, the Civil War had destroyed the trappings and substance of the slaveocracy in the South, and there was an opportunity to change the Constitution because they knew that's where they had to go because slavery had been written into the Constitution because the ability of a few to deny the rights of many had been written into the Constitution and then codified in all the state laws. They drove the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments into the Constitution of the United States because they were ready. They had thought about it. They knew what they needed to do. And they didn't set up a slave protection agency. And then you had a flourishing of a moment, a historical moment for a decade or so with Reconstruction and the amendments and laws that were passed in Congress. Which some people call a second American Revolution. It was sort of the intermediate between the slave state and the rise of the corporate state, when people actually tried to build a democracy state, as some people had intended from the beginning, to be characterized by free labor, no wage slavery to replace chattel slavery. And unfortunately, that was crushed. So you drive the 13th Amendment into the Constitution, which abolishes involuntary servitude. It was called the Glorious Labor Amendment. And it was applied to, you know, at the time, white workers understood it applied to them. And what it was about was that there should be no slavery in any form in this country. That we were to be free. The self-governing people were to be free with no limits on what we could do to govern ourselves. And we passed the 14th Amendment, barring states from denying equal protection and due process of law to people. And Reconstruction was about doing all kinds of extraordinary things, opening up the protecting the rights of African Americans and reconfiguring the South in a democratic way. And that was all crushed. And then you had the irony, the worst in irony, is that the 14th Amendment became one of the primary tools for the corporate class to clothe itself in the Constitution of the United States. So think of it this way. You got a people's movement, one of the greatest, noblest people's movement in the history of the earth, driving the struggle to end slavery in this country and into the Constitution. Across several generations, it took a lot of blood, a lot of suffering. And out of that blood and suffering and struggle, they drive it into the Constitution of the United States. They drive it into the culture, the notion that slavery is abhorrent, and that you cannot have a democracy when anybody's enslaved, when the law is denying the rights of some people in order to help other people. And only 20 years later, you get some judges on the Supreme Court without even a drop of sweat coming down their brow, taking the 14th Amendment and just wrapping it around the corporate class, enabling them to wield the Constitution against us over 100 years later. 100 years of accumulated corporate state law. We've had 100 years of accumulated corporate state law. They have rewritten our creation story. They have gotten into our minds. They channel our thinking. They channel our civic activism. They diminish our aspirations. We don't talk about what we really want. We think about, oh, maybe this is the best we can do. You know, I've been reading about the struggle of the levelers and ranters and Anabaptists and Quakers in the 1600s. And it's extraordinary how much that struggle, everything about it, reminds me of the populist struggle. Because here you had people, and this was the time, the 1600s in England, you had a revolt against the monarchy. You had the beheading of King Charles in 1840. You had the Glorious Revolution. And some of the upper-class people who were trying to get Charles out needed the rabble. And so they helped to embrace some of the rabble in that struggle, as long as they needed him, just as happened in the American Revolution. And yet this was not an ordinary rabble. And what you had was ordinary people at the time who had been forced off their land by enclosures, who had been pressed into merchant marine and into the East India Company ships, who had been subject to enormous violence, actually starting to ask questions about what they had been taught, standing up to the church of the time. And the church was really a church state country, questioning the creation story, questioning bringing their own experience to bear, rethinking the purpose of life. And in fact, they're the ones, they left an extraordinary record of the ideas that actually formed this country, which are often attributed to servants of slave owners in England and in Europe. The notion of consent of the governed and inalienable rights, a trial by jury, and no cruel and inhuman punishment, and a man's home is his castle, and freedom of speech, and freedom of thought, and freedom of assembly. That's the kind of ideas that they were putting forward. And so after the king had been beheaded, and after the new nobles took over, they had no need for this rabble, and they wiped them out, and they wiped out a huge amount of that history. And the same thing happened after the populists. What did we have after the populists were crushed at the end of the 1900s? We have the movement for the next 15 years or so that's called the Progressive Era. And we learn more about that in school than we learn about the populists. And I think it's very important in the process of rethinking how we got here, how we got into this mess, to see that the progressives were almost the opposite of the populists, in that they basically conceded that the corporation would be the dominant institution of our time, and that the best that they could do would be to try to make it a little less bad, to try to find the best men to run it and to kind of control them around the edges. And so when we got to the New Deal during the Great Depression, it's very important, I think, to understand that it was, in fact, the progressive agenda that the New Deal picked up and not the populist agenda. And so what I learned in school, what I learned through the culture, is that, in fact, there was a constitutional revolution during the New Deal. And I think that's way overstated. In fact, none of the issues that we're talking about that gave rise to the corporate state, that enables the corporation to claim constitutional rights and to use the state to wield those rights against us, against our communities, against the animals and plants and the rivers and trees and the mountains, none of that was even challenged. It wasn't on the table. What's happening in Pennsylvania is that in a few places, people are rethinking the nature of the problems in which they find themselves immersed. They're thinking about how they got here, how they got into the mess. Many of these people are, most of them, frankly, are rural Republicans. You know, Tom and I were up in a northern rural county last week, meeting with Republican elected county supervisors. And if something very funny happened, they were there because they're in danger of having one of the hills strip mined, and they've been fighting it for a while. And one of the Republican county officials said to me, you know, when Katie McGinty was appointed head of the Department of Environmental Protection in Pennsylvania, they were worried that she would be too environmental because she was Clinton and Gore's, she was in the Clinton and Gore administration, she was head of the Council on Environmental Quality, so she's got a reputation as this big environmentalist. So they were worried when she became head of the Pennsylvania State Environmental Department that she would be too environmental. They went through their process up there trying to stop the strip mine and found that DEP was on the strip mine side. So, you know, trying to explain, it's nothing to do with political parties. It doesn't matter about the personalities, it's who they are. It's what the law is and how we've got to this point. That the company had the right, they owned the mineral rights, and they had the right to take down that mountain if that's what they wanted to do. So people in Pennsylvania are beginning to think differently. There's some different conversations going on around pretty much many places around the country. And it's not about the corporation. It's about us. It's about who we are, what we want, what our responsibilities are as people, as human beings on this earth and in this country, what our responsibilities are to the people who came before us and to the other creatures of the world that cannot speak for themselves and cannot act for themselves. And it's about being ready to take some very different steps that are related to violating what's called settled law. You know, there's been no movement worth its salt, starting with the levelers, going through the American Revolution, the rebels, the abolition movement, the workers' movement, the women's movement, civil rights movement, any gay and lesbian movement, where fundamentally the people in this movement, in these movements, have agreed with the fundamental basis of the laws that were oppressing them. That in every case they got to a point where they said, these laws are illegitimate, this thinking is irrational, these theories are nuts and they're illegitimate, and all they have is some precedent behind them and some important people who are behind them, but they're garbage and we're not going to allow ourselves to be governed by them. There's been no movement. There has been no movement worth its salt which didn't think that way. I want to close by reading two short things. One is from a book called The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher Hill, which is about that 1600s struggle. He talks about history. History has to be rewritten in each generation, because although the past does not change, the present does. Each new generation asks new questions of the past and finds new areas of sympathy as it relives different aspects of the experience of its predecessors. Each generation must rescue a new area from what its predecessors arrogantly and snobbishly dismissed as the, quote, lunatic fringe. That's us with the lunatic fringe. I assume that's because you're here. But there will be a time when, in fact, some very strange and different people will consider us very rational and quite down to earth. I guess before I read the final closing, I want to just take another little thing out of history, because, you know, we often talk about not just who gets to wield the law and the Constitution against whom, but who gets to define everything. I mean, law, I've learned that law is about definitions. As soon as you define something, you don't ever have to explain it again, because if you define something as XYZ, and you know, then that's what it is. So if a slave is defined as a non-person, you never, you know, when there's something comes up in the law dealing with it, you never relate to the fact that this is a human being. It's always a non-person. It's property. So, you know, this, the property did this, or sold the property, but whatever. So who gets to define stuff is really important. And so I wanted to take an instance which is very famous. You'll all probably know about it. A decision by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes coming out of the Espionage Act of 1917, World War I. So you had a pamphleteer in New York City, an anarchist socialist, put out a pamphlet urging people, men, not to respond to the draft and not to become cannon fodder in World War I for the munitions and for Wall Street. And he was arrested in violation of the Espionage Act of 1917. And he lost his trial and he appealed, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's the case in which Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing for I think a unanimous court, wrote the decision. And it's the decision where he talked about, you know, nobody has the right to falsely cry fire in a crowded theater. You all have heard of that decision, right? Yes? Ah, good. And so that has the power of lore behind it, and law as well. I mean, it's a very powerful piece of the creation story. And boy, that makes sense. Of course somebody shouldn't falsely cry fire in a crowded theater and endanger everybody's lives, right? Well, go back and read the case. Go back and put yourself there. Here's a person, one of many, many people, who was saying, there is a conflagration going on in Europe. There is a fire. It is horrendous. It is stupid. The United States should not be part of that. Woodrow Wilson is deceiving, had deceived this country to get into that war worse than what this Bush did. There is a fire going on. I'm saying there's a fire going on. I'm a human being. I'm a person. I'm saying there's a fire going on. And Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Supreme Court says, what fire? There's no fire. You have somebody crying fire falsely. There's no First Amendment for anybody like that. He goes to jail. That is taught. I mean, that's a doctrine. That's a doctrine. Think of it. There was a fire going on. A lot of people saw the fire. But the Supreme Court said there was no fire. And so there was no fire. How is that different from the Supreme Court saying in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 that it's okay for the law of states to deny the rights of African Americans? I mean, how is it different from a zillion other ways in which the corporate class and representatives of the slave class of the corporate class has defined people, has defined our lives, and then put the power of law behind it? So it's we've got a lot to undo, because we have really a couple of millennia to undo of the few ruling the many. It didn't just start in the United States. There's a lot to undo. And there's a lot of work to be done. A lot of the work is up here. A lot of the work is up here. And I would say, don't try it at home alone. You need other people to do that work. And we're going to have to be violating what they say is the law and what they say is the law. And we're going to have to put ourselves in a place where they say, you are a traitor because you are preventing freedom and you're preventing security, you're preventing jobs, you're preventing growth, you're preventing all the great things that we know is the heart of America. And what can happen to you if you try to be logical? You know, this is what's going to happen. One of the cases, I'm going to close by reading from one of the cases that's been filed in Pennsylvania, that Tom is the lawyer for a community group in St. Thomas Township, and in which we've raised all these questions about corporate illegitimacy, the illegitimacy of the Constitution, the illegitimacy of the decisions of the Supreme Court. You know, we had to write very long briefs because we couldn't use the bumper sticker. You know, their briefs come back and say, oh, blah, 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 cite the case. Blah, 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 cite the case. We could go back and read the case and say, well, it's not about that. It's not about this. This is, anyway. So here it is. So not only is the corporation, this is against the Quarry Corporation. And the Quarry Corporation is seeking the court to throw out the whole case because it has no merit. That's not enough for them. They've asked the judge to sanction Attorney Lindsay, to apply penalties to him, primarily probably to pay the court, the lawyers for the corporation. But I want to read just two paragraphs from their brief to the court on why Thomas Lindsay should be sanctioned. So it's not about Lindsay. This is about all of us who have any little thing in us who might think this way. Attorney Lindsay concedes in part five of his brief that for over 100 years, corporations have had federal constitutional rights and that the Supreme Court has consistently protected those rights. Well, we told the history in the brief. That's what that's about. The preposterous claim by Attorney Lindsay that he has the slightest chance of success here is disproven by the very arguments he advances. Attorney Lindsay asserts that his position is, quote, anchored in old and ongoing legal discussions. In fact, those, quote, old and ongoing legal discussions have all been squarely rejected repeatedly by the courts, and the issue is fully settled against Lindsay's position. It's all settled law. Remember that term. It's all settled law. That's it. Forget it. Just as the unlawfulness of polygamy is well settled, notwithstanding continuing legal discussion among certain fringe persons who would challenge the practice of polygamy, and just as the illegality of the federal income tax is discussed among certain fringe anti-tax advocates, it is patently unmeritorious and frivolous, which is a legal word, a legal term, it's a definition, for Mr. Lindsay to come before this court with and require the defendants here to defend against his attack on a key component of the socioeconomic fabric of this nation. This component consists in the ability of persons to form corporations in order to pursue charitable and business endeavors, and the federal constitutional rights of those corporations to be treated equally before the law. Attorney Lindsay's claims in this instant case simply have no possibility of success, and Attorney Lindsay, being educated and intelligent, clearly knew that when he brought this suit. Listen up to this next paragraph, because it's about you. If Attorney Lindsay is not sanctioned here, he and others will be encouraged to clutter the federal courts with baseless claims. They will argue in every case where a corporation and individual human beings are on the opposite sides of a dispute that the corporation's rights may not be vindicated in the courts, because by asserting the right to an unbiased forum, the corporation is somehow in violation of the civil rights laws of the United States of America. This argument is totally fallacious, without any supportable reasoning, and warrants sanctions pursuant to Rule 11, which sanctions should be imposed, quote, quoting from the law, to deter repetition of such conduct or comparable conduct by others similarly situated. They will tell us over and over again, the most important people will tell us, publishers, law school deans, judges, editors, politicians, mayors, they will tell us all this stuff has been settled long ago. We have no chance whatsoever. The court cannot even hear. They're throwing this out. The judge won't even hear this case. Won't let the petitioners, the community group, come and make the case before her in person. They don't want to hear it. So all to say, the courts are not our venues here. They're not our courts. For long ages, they have not been our courts. Our venue is the village square. Our venue is the streets. Our venue is our legislatures. We make the law. That is our responsibility as the sovereign people. Go read your own Washington State Constitution as well. The people are the source of all political power in this country. It's not true until we exercise our power. It's not true until we exercise our rights. It is only we who can do that. It's not about the corporate leaders. It's not about the corporations. It's about us and what kind of government that we impose, because we organize enough and we're smart enough and we're persistent enough and stubborn enough, like Lindsay, and intelligent enough in order to actually demand and then get what we want and not leave it to somebody else to tell us and define us and say, this is all you can ask for. Thank you very much.